From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'll be filling in for the next couple of weeks while Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's show, I speak with pianist and conductor Leon Fleischer. After a neurological disorder struck his right hand, Fleischer turned to piano works written for the left hand alone. Also today, I speak with Yehudi Menuhin. Menuhin was a child prodigy who developed into one of the world's great violinists. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Whatever Next, the new album from British clarinetist Wally Fox, and television critic David Bian Cooley reviews Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam, a new HBO documentary. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. At the age of 16, my guest pianist Leon Fleischer made his debut at Carnegie Hall, a debut that turned out to be historic. He began playing the piano at the age of 4, was accepted to study with Arthur Schnabel when he was 9, and went on to become one of the world's most celebrated pianists. Fleischer's recordings of the Beethoven Piano Concerti, performed with the Cleveland Orchestra under the direction of George Sell, is considered the definitive version of those works. From those recordings, here is Leon Fleischer performing the opening of the 5th concerto, The Emperor. In 1964, at the height of his career, Fleischer was struck with a muscular problem in his right hand that made it too difficult and painful to play. He turned to conducting and began performing the piano repertoire written for the left hand only. In 1981, Fleischer had surgery, allowing him to play with his injured right hand for short periods. The next year, he performed with both hands in a concert with the Baltimore Symphony. He's continuing therapy on his right hand, but still devotes most of his time to teaching and conducting. He is the artistic director of the Tanglewood Music Center, music director of the Kennedy Center's Theater Chamber Players, and a professor of music at Johns Hopkins University. Fleischer has recently developed an interest in ballet, and I asked him how it ties into his other work in music.
All this has to do with movement, with gesture, with momentum, with drive, whatever you want to call it. And I've discovered that people who sit at this instrument, the piano, and depress any number of levers in any kind of succession at any kind of speed don't get an opportunity, really, a sufficient opportunity, to learn how to express gesture and movement. And I find myself in my classes, in my lessons, kind of striding around the room and waving my arms and demonstrating, like a conductor very much will, to exemplify shapes of phrases, shapes of movements. And it came to me. My wife takes ballet 2 or 3 times a week, in addition to her teaching of piano and everything else. And it came to me that this is really very, very clearly demonstrative of what I'm trying to say. So I started recommending to my students to take ballet, to take movement courses. And then, of course, it came to me, if I recommend that for them, I'm certainly going to have to be the first to do it.
Do you feel any change?
Yes. You mean personally?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, it's a marvelous exercise. It's a great activity. It's truly wonderful. And I have the benefit of having a very gifted teacher. And it does clarify that sense of continuity, that sense of momentum, the sense of suspension, all the things that are, all the elements, or many of the elements that are in music are inherent. Ballet is just a kind of physical manifestation to a certain extent of what music is. It certainly gives me a far greater awareness of the quality of the gesture that's used.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading about you that you said you, when you first started conducting, you were so used to, with your instrument as your art form, sitting down at something.
Yes.
That you started sitting down.
Yes.
You conducted sitting down.
Right. It was very unnatural for me to be standing in front of a group of musicians.
Why did you get up?
It seems a little affected to remain sitting unless you're, you know, in a physical condition that requires it. It's easier for all the musicians to see you, and that's really mm-hmm. kind of the way it's done.
You didn't want to call that much attention to yourself doing that.
Yeah, and also I feel a lot more comfortable, natural doing it now.
You know, I rarely hear accomplished conductors talk anymore about that first moment when they picked up a baton and realized, you know, I guess you must get beyond all that, and realize that when you did this, when you moved this way, they did something. Do you remember?
When I really first became aware that a good orchestra, which is, you know, made up of 90, 100 good, experienced musicians, will respond to the slightest differentiation of in a movement, I was suddenly filled with almost with a kind of dread, with a kind of fear, because when you look at great conductors, when you look at a Klemperer or a Furtwängler or von Karajan, it seems so simple. It seems almost simplistic. You see some conductors who are terribly fancy, terribly elegant, and or who are something like, you know, they look like Errol Flynn wielding his épée in The Flying Pirate or whatever the name of the picture he used to make. But you look at the really great ones, and it looks like your little, it's what your little 7-year-old does in front of the Victrola. Until you begin to realize that what looks simple is really a distillate of decades of experience. They don't need all the fancy stuff. And in a way, it's not only the arm movement, but in great conductors, it's eye contact. And not just looking at the player, because that can be very intimidating in a way. In fact, one of the things you have to learn as a conductor is not to look at the player in the orchestra that has the solo.
Oh, really?
Oh, particularly with horn players. If a horn has a very important solo or a great call, never look at him before it happens. That's terrible. Ignore him.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all the instruments that do the accompanying and give him absolutely as much psychological freedom as possible. So when I first realized that their response is that sensitive,
why dread?
Because then you have the responsibility to be you have the obligation to be responsible for every gesture that you make. You know, can't mm-hmm. be any accidents. Can't be. You really have to begin to work at conducting the way an instrumentalist works at his instrument.
Was there a sense that first time when you took that baton and raised it in the air and first downbeat in the orchestra came forth with this sound? Mm. Was it thrilling? Would you
No.
describe it as thrilling?
It was scary as hell. Because there is a lag time between
when you make the movement and when the sound appears in most orchestras. There are some conductors, George Sell was one of them, that insisted that the moment the stick in its downward arc hit a certain point, that was when he wanted the sound. There are some orchestras, I think the best example of which is the Berlin Philharmonic, is that after the stick hits that point, there is often a lag of almost, if not more, than a full second, which is an enormous amount of time. I remember specifically, this was back in the 60s, I played Mozart's C major concerto with Sell and the Berlin Philharmonic. We were guests at the Salzburg Festival. And the Berlin Philharmonic was the orchestra of Furtwängler at that time, who was the subject of no end of extraordinary stories, whose downbeat seemed to tremble in the air as it went slowly from head level down to waist level. And where in the midst of that voyage the orchestra would come in with a pum, you know, absolutely together. It's, you know, those are the great mysteries of life. And we started the first fanfare chord, the opening chord, big C major chord, and Sell made his gesture, and the orchestra came in very late, full second late, and he stopped. Gentlemen, no, I want it with the beat. And he spent a good 5 minutes getting that chord placed exactly where he wanted it with the beat. It's a great orchestra. Mm-hmm. And they got it fine. Came to the performance, he gives the downbeat and the chord is a full second later again. they have a habit of doing what is safe for them. They have a great team pride. And just because they have a guest coach, you know, they ain't gonna change their system of play.
I hate to say it, but it sounds smart to me.
It is, in a way.
Sell, and I noticed something in your publicity kit. A while back, you received lots of attention for a record you made of the 5 Beethoven piano concertos with the Cleveland Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And now people are always saying they're still considered definitive.
Mm-hmm.
What do they mean? What are they talking about? For people who don't listen to classical music all of the time, what is happening with those 5 concertos that made people say that? And your performance?
Yeah, it's the first time I've ever been asked that question. Really, very impressive. Let's see, they were made 57, 58, 59, and around there. Well, they're still selling. I guess is one possible answer.
Uh-huh.
I really can't speak to that other than to say it's, you know, it was one of the great orchestras of the world in its heyday under one of the great conductors of the world.
Yeah.
We had a kind of musical and spiritual rapport that was really quite extraordinary. It was almost personal. It was very curious because there was comparatively little personal contact between the two of us because we both had our you know individual careers and we were both very busy. But in terms of age, I guess I was I fit into the generation that was old enough or young enough to be his son.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds a wee bit trite, but there was in a musical sense, it was very much like father and son. In the most ideal of circumstances, in other words, it wasn't a parent that insisted that the son follow the precepts of the parent. It was a father that was supportive, proud, and of the child, and perfectly willing to let the child be himself with every confidence in the integrity of the child. You know, one of those ideal family kind of relationships.
Mm-hmm. Are you always searching for it again? Do you want to?
Oh, sure. That's one of the great things about making music. It's one of the drawbacks as well, because you can on one evening you can have a great performance, and the next evening or two evenings later, you have to go out and play the same piece. You have to get back in shape for it.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a week later, a month later, whatever it is. It has to be done again, and yet that's the refreshment of it, and you are not locked in to one concept. You know, it's always a growing learning experience. You don't get penalized for changing your mind.
Sometimes it strikes me how similar music is to theater and how I keep imagining the casting person in all of this, someone sitting back and saying, trying to create that moment, not just this time the right set designer, the right actor, the right play, but in this case, the right conductor, the right soloist, and the right orchestra to make that, for instance, that time that you had that triad with them, with Sel, to make that happen again someplace.
Yeah. Well, it's truly astounding. In fact, I think it's probably a little, in a way, a little different from the theater. In that, I think most great musicians will accept the premise that the music is really greater than the sum of its parts, meaning soloist, conductor, orchestra. So that you start off from a point of modesty, if you will, before the masterpiece of the music. And I'm speaking with the best artists. It's usually the artists who are less than the best that become very insistent upon their way as the only way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, in the theater, there are extracurricular, what I would call extracurricular elements, such as maybe appearance, the appropriateness of the appearance of the actor or actress for that specific role. They might conceptually and even artistically do a marvelous role, but they're not terribly believable, let's say, from the point of view of, mm-hmm. the way they look. You know, if you saw I don't know why I'm getting back to Errol Flynn a second time. But, you know, if you saw an Errol Flynn as a Cyrano, it doesn't work. He might have, I doubt it, of course, but he might have done it, even if he had did the best Cyrano, it just you know, wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think these considerations enter into music.
Pianist and conductor Leon Fleischer is my guest. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Leon Fleischer is my guest. In the mid-60s, he was struck with a muscular disorder in his right hand, which prevented him from playing the piano. He then discovered a piano repertoire written for the left hand only. We're going to listen to part of a recording Fleischer made of Ravel's Concerto in D for the left hand. Why did composers start making music for the left hand?
Well, the vast majority of music for the left hand was due to a terrible accident that happened to a pianist in the First World War. His name was Paul Wittgenstein, and he had his right arm shot off as a result of the war. Came, I think he was either brother or cousin to Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, mm-hmm. very well-to-do family, and with a kind of
extraordinary personal courage, he would not accept that as an end to his career. Mm. And he commissioned the composers of the day to write works for the left hand.
How great. Is anyone doing it for the right hand? Did anyone?
It's also an interesting question. There is virtually, in comparison to what's written for the left hand, there is virtually nothing written for right hand alone.
Isn't that something?
But that's curiously enough, for musical reasons. In that it is a demonstration of the fact that of the three elements of music, rhythm, harmony, and melody, though melody is the one that we all whistle, we don't whistle harmony particularly, mm-hmm. and we don't whistle rhythm particularly, that in fact melody is the least important. Hmm. Because when you play with the left hand, you are to a large extent down in the bass, where you have the possible of the harmonic fundament, which is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you move around the piano and you can tap the tune out with your thumb, but most of the hand has to be involved with making harmony and rhythm.
Hmm.
And if you were up in the top of the piano, it doesn't make it. Wouldn't make it. There's a gentleman in Chicago named Norman Malone who has made a doctoral study, wrote his thesis on the left-hand literature, and he's come up with over 300 works for left-hand alone.
Isn't that something?
So one can have a career.
Yeah, a lot to choose from.
Yeah.
My guest has been pianist and conductor Leon Fleischer. CBS Records has been issuing on compact disc many of his classic recordings with George Sell and the Cleveland Orchestra. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Andrew Weil, a medical doctor with a holistic approach. He has studied the medicinal use of plants around the world and written books such as The Natural Mind, A New Way of Looking at Drugs and the Higher Consciousness, and Health and Healing, A Guide to Holistic Health. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. Coming up, I speak with Yehudi Menuhin, one of classical music's preeminent violinists and an avid student of art, politics, psychology, and philosophy. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Wally Fox and the Soho Shakers. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Dear America. It's a new HBO documentary about the Vietnam War that combines stock footage with letters home from the troops. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Today, Richard Gephardt dropped out of the race for the Democratic nomination for president, NPR's Linda Wertheimer reports.
Congressman Richard Gephardt won the Iowa caucuses and came in a creditable second to Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis in New Hampshire. But although Gephardt's message that the United States should get tough on trade seemed to find an interested audience in the first two states, when Gephardt got to the massive Southern primary on March 8, he did not have the funds to compete with Dukakis or with Southern candidate Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee, who had saved his money to make the Southern fight. Nor could Gephardt compete with the massive black voter support that flooded to Jesse Jackson in the South. After Super Tuesday, Gephardt hoped for a revival in Michigan, the auto manufacturing state, hard hit by imports from Asia. But, said Gephardt, by the time he got to Michigan, too many people had already written him off. Gephardt says he plans to file tomorrow for the Missouri House seat he holds now, and instead of running for president, he will run for Congress. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington.
The Israeli cabinet has approved a secret agreement to cooperate with the prosecution in the Iran-Contra case. The special prosecutor in the case, Lawrence Walsh, announced today that he signed the agreement with Israel. In congressional testimony about the scandal last year, witnesses said that Israeli officials were involved in the early stages of the secret U.S. arms sales to Iran. Walsh has tried unsuccessfully to get Israeli officials to testify in the case. Under the new agreement, he will drop the subpoenas. About 800 American troops left Honduras today to return to their American bases. They are part of a 3,200 troop exercise sent into Honduras nearly 2 weeks ago after reports of a Nicaraguan invasion of Honduras. Representatives of the Nicaraguan government and Contra rebels are meeting in Sipawa, Nicaragua today. They are working out details of a ceasefire agreement negotiated last week. General Manuel Noriega proved again today that he controls the streets of Panama City, as well as the Panamanian government. Demonstrators marched to call for his ouster, but they'd only gone about half a mile when Noriega's troops broke up the march with water cannons and tear gas. Peter Cattell reports from Panama City.
The National Civil Crusade called a march in order to step up pressure on Noriega to quit as military commander-in-chief and leave Panama. Noriega's opponents plan to march down a street where commerce has been shut down for a week by a business strike called by the crusade. Some 2,500 protesters appeared for the demonstration, with organizers saying others had been scared away by the number of troops patrolling the streets. However, as marchers began heading toward the Avenida Central shopping district, there were some indications that the military might break precedent by allowing the protest to proceed. Street demonstrations have been illegal in Panama since last October. Troops in battle dress carrying shotguns and tear gas launchers allowed the march to begin, a switch from the usual practice of breaking up protests immediately. However, when protesters reached Avenida Central, a truck spraying water laced with pepper gas launched into the march. Soldiers firing tear gas followed as demonstrators hurtled down side streets and into tenements. Noriega used a challenge to his power to demonstrate that he still runs Panama. Peter Cattell in Panama City.
House Speaker Jim Wright today said he had no idea that one of his own advisors had tried to sell weapons to Oliver North's secret Contra supply network. The advisor, Richard Pena, is a former House Foreign Affairs Committee staff member and has been one of Wright's advisors on Central America. Pena contacted North's associate Richard Miller 3 months before the arms sales were made public, offering grenades, bombs, mines, and boots for the Contras from two South American companies. The special congressional committees investigating the matter decided not to pursue Pena's involvement, and attorneys say it appears his activities were not illegal. The stock market ended its decline today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed today at 1979.77.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from the British jazz composer and clarinetist Wally Fox. Fox is now in his late 60s and has been part of the British traditional jazz scene since its beginnings in the early 1940s. Now, some English critics consider Fox their country's greatest jazz clarinetist. Kevin says Fox's new album showcases the best of the British traditional movement.
In the early 40s, when the Dixieland revival got underway in the U.S., a parallel movement called trad sprung up in Britain. Like Dixieland, trad has a lousy critical reputation because the bad outweighs the good. Sometimes it's bad enough to be good. Anybody remember trumpeter Kenny Ball's 1963 take on Sukiyaki? That's bad. But even good trad comes with built-in booby traps. The classic New Orleans style trad is based on flourished and began to fade before 1930. The trick for revivalists is to stick close to that style without sounding quaint or archaic. It's not easy. But English clarinetist and trad vet Wally Fox deftly sidesteps disaster on his album Whatever Next for the American specialty label Stomp Off. No put down of Fox to say that he distinguishes himself as much by what he doesn't do as by what he does. In the first place, nobody sings, so you run no risk of hearing a white Englishman do an offensive and tin-eared impression of southern black dialect. In bad trad, a drummer slugs out every other beat as a banjo player plinks noisy chords. But Fox's group, the Soho Shakers, usually a quintet, contains neither banjoist nor drummer. About the only thing wrong with his rhythm section is the sometimes artificially percussive rinky-dink sound of the piano Martin Litton must play. Graham Reed is an able bass and tuba player, but the band's linchpin is guitarist Paul Seeley. You can hear a little modern harmony and some Django Reinhardt swing in his solos, and a lot of Count Basie's partner Freddie Green in his even strumming. After 1930, most jazz musicians followed Basie's lead, adopting a smooth four-beat pulse that made the old two-beat obsolete. The Soho Shakers inobtrusively drift toward the more modern approach. Here's Wally Fox Blues' Whatever Next, one of two quote-unquote originals here. Ben Cohen solos on his homemade hybrid of trumpet and cornet. Thank you. of such tunes as period pieces. As a rule, period pieces reveal the time in which they're made as much or more than the time in which they're set. Linda Evans might have dressed like a cowgirl back on the Big Valley, but her 5-inch eyelashes were strictly mod 60s. Wally Fox, who has referred to himself as a neo-troglodyte, mixes old and new in much the same way. The playing here is rarely stunning, and the leader's clarinet is pretty nasal, but this music has convincing spirit. At a time when modernists are reinvestigating the music's New Orleans heritage, conservators of tradition like Fox may be more valuable than ever.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Wally Fox's new album, Whatever Next, on the Stomp Off label. This is Fresh Air. Many play the violin, but there are only a very few musicians who make the instrument sound as sweet as Yehudi Menuhin does. Menuhin's had a long and distinguished career that began with his first violin lesson in San Francisco shortly after his fourth birthday. His talent was immediately apparent. Before he turned 10, he'd performed professionally in San Francisco and New York. He was a world celebrity by the time he was 11 years old. Throughout his career, Menuhin has rarely strayed far from the great concert stages of Europe and the United States, whether performing or, more recently, guest conducting. I spoke with Yehudi Menuhin when he was teaching master classes at the Hart School of Music in Hartford, Connecticut. Although it's been many years since Menuhin was a student himself, he has no trouble relating to his pupils.
I have not forgotten at all what it is to be uncertain, to be searching, to be uncomfortable, unhappy, sometimes even desperate and dejected. Nor have I forgotten, nor do I ever forget, what it is to suffer and under any conditions. I mean, I've been very lucky, had a minimum of that in my life, but I'm always aware of that in other people and other situations.
You were considered a child prodigy. Was there a time when you realized that you could do, as a child, what the other kids around you could not do? Did you ever feel odd or like a freak?
No, I never felt a freak. Perhaps I should have, but I've never liked the word, you know, prodigy, child prodigy. First of all, I was with my sisters. My Hefziba played the piano very well. I was in the city that at that time already boasted quite a few good violinists. I mean, there was Ruggero Ricci, there was Isaac Stern, and it was a city that seemed to inspire good young people who went hiking in the in Marin County, and the air was good and the water was drinkable, and altogether it was a very wholesome city, so it was an ideal city. There were good concerts, symphony, and then, on the other hand, there were plenty of children who could do things I couldn't do. I mean, they could play ball with such precision that one saw them from time to time on the streets, and in that way, athletically, do things that I never could do, never learned to do.
Now, when you look at students today and you compare them to students in the music conservatories 40 years ago, what's the difference?
Well, today the field of musical expression is so much widened. It was a very classical period. When I grew up, Beethoven was bread and butter. That was our daily food. Then now, the development of not only jazz, but contemporary music, the exploration of the past, early music, medieval music, other civilizations, India, China, Japan, Bali, Africa.
Has Suzuki made a difference?
I think he has. I think he responded to a need for bringing instrumental experience and proficiency to a greater number of young people, and realizing that you had to begin young. And I mean, the gypsy boy, infant, listens to his father playing the violin and twiddles around with two sticks of wood and tries to imitate that at the age of 2 and 3. And Suzuki is simply an organized adaptation of a natural urge, just as if we send our children to school at the age of 2 and 3, in kindergarten, we'd like them to learn to dance. Now, the African child doesn't have to learn to dance. It dances with its mother carried on the back, and gradually knows the rhythms, and by the time its feet are on the ground, it dances.
Mm-hmm. You want to talk about orchestras for just a minute? Years ago, we all thought that orchestras had an absolutely individual sound. And then people started to say it changed. They started to sound more homogeneous. What do you think?
Well, I think that is a valid point. When I was a boy, an English orchestra was composed of Englishmen, French of French, German, Italian. Only the American orchestras have been for a long time mixed bodies from different cultures. And that accounts also for much of their brilliance and versatility. But the orchestras in themselves had their own traditions. And it was interesting to come to France and hear the French woodwinds or the German brass. Now, as you say, the migrating races, the nomads, the refugees, whether Jewish and more recently Asian, are naturally going to bring something. That tends naturally to create a mixture which is a bit more the same everywhere. And yet I've been so surprised. What you say has both advantages and disadvantages. For instance, I played the Elgar Concerto 2 years ago in Paris with a French orchestra. But I'd played it twice before with a French orchestra. Three times. Once, when Elgar himself came to conduct it, and Enesco had prepared the orchestra. And that was a good performance. But it was Enesco and Elgar, and after all, they had respect for Enesco, and he understood the music to perfection. Then I played it twice again with French orchestras and with French conductors, and it never was quite what it should be. Finally, I did it with the Barenboim's assistant, excellent conductor, who was first violinist, and who is now his own orchestra in Lyon. That orchestra gave me as good an accompaniment to the Elgar Concerto as I've ever had. Now, that is a story that spans 50 years, and that's an example of what you are saying, of what has happened. The French orchestra today can play, under right guidance, an Elgar Concerto, or Brahms, or works which before they were not quite at home, or Wagner, as well as anybody.
That's a great story. Now, when people talk about your humanitarian efforts, I think about the time in your life during World War II when you were performing so many concerts for soldiers in Britain. And I wondered if that experience then in World War II changed you politically.
Oh, certainly it affected me enormously as a human being, because it made up a great deal for the school years I never had. And going to these camps and playing everywhere, wherever I gave a concert in America, too, whether it, you know, Dakota or Florida, there was always an army camp where I played. The same applied to Central America, the same to South America, and of course special trips for the forces, as I did to the Aleutian Islands. And when I went to England, I went not only for the Americans, but for all the troops there and for public concerts. I was struck when I played at this army prison in England, American, by the words of the officer in command, who said, "You know, what I'd like you to know and tell you is that we won't have any trouble for the next week." That is really quite a definite statement of confirming the therapeutic effect. How somehow good music will dissolve certain frustrations, or at least it does something to the human being.
Violinist Yehudi Menuhin has just finished a U.S. tour. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Faith. How are you?
I'm fine. What story are you following?
Well, following up on the victory by Jesse Jackson in the Michigan Democratic caucuses, we'll be talking with two men, journalist Fred Barnes and Bert Lance, former director of the Office of Management and the Budget and an advisor to Jesse Jackson, who differ on the proposition Jesse Jackson is electable. We'll also be hearing from Gerald Schechter and his son. Jerry Schechter was Time magazine correspondent in Moscow back in the late 60s and until 1970. Took his family back to Moscow last year to see how much things had changed.
Sounds good. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the past couple of years, there have been a slew of feature films from Hollywood about the Vietnam War. This weekend, Home Box Office is showing a documentary about Vietnam. Television critic David Bianculli says it depicts the war as powerfully as anything he's ever seen.
In 1969, when the Vietnam War and the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour were both going strong, Smothers Brothers writer Mason Williams wrote this in his journal. "Saw on the news that 196 American soldiers were killed in Vietnam this past week. I think it would be more effective to flash on a one-second picture of 196 soldiers in succession." Williams went on to write, "Of course, at 1 second each, that would be a total of over 3 minutes, and network time is too expensive to waste on making the point that 196 Americans died for their country last week." Well, it's taken almost 20 years, but a new HBO documentary is devoting a full 90 minutes to the soldiers who served in Vietnam, and doing it the way Williams suggested. In fact, this special goes even farther. We not only see their faces, but we hear their music, the music they listen to on Armed Forces radio. And, most important, we hear the letters they wrote home. The special is called Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam, and it's a remarkable piece of research and filmmaking. Director Bill Cotery, co-producer Thomas Bird, and co-writer Richard Dewhurst have put together something truly different here. Still photos, war footage, lots of personal movie film taken by soldiers. All of it is used to bring to life what is written in these letters. Actors take turns reading the letters, actors like Robert De Niro, Sean Penn, Robin Williams, Kathleen Turner, but they're never seen on camera. Instead, we see the real war, photographed at ground level by the troops and newsmen who were there, and we hear their deepest thoughts as written to their truest friends.
"Dear Red, Anyone over here who walks more than 50 feet through elephant grass should automatically get a Purple Heart. Try to imagine grass possessing razor-sharp edges, 8 to 15 feet high, so thick as to cut visibility to 1 yard. Then try to imagine walking through it while all around...
We're all scared. One can easily see this emotion in the eyes of each individual. One might hide it with his mouth, while another might hide it with his actions. But there is no way around it. We are all scared.
Some of the stuff in Letters Home from Vietnam is amazing. The depth of the research in digging up the visuals to match with the letters is incredible. We see home movies of a soldier goofing around on the base as we hear his letter describing an upcoming battle and how lucky he feels about it. And then we see him in the jungle in film shot by someone else, and he's dead. Later, we see a battlefield funeral for a Lieutenant Gary A. Scott, while another soldier who served in his platoon writes about it to his father.
This country is no game that I can see, Dad. We're fighting, dying for people who resent our being over here. Oh, I'll probably get a Bronze Star for the firefight. Lieutenant Scott will get a Silver Star. That will help me get a job someday, and it is supposed to suffice for Lieutenant Scott's life. I guess I'm bitter now, Dad. This war is all wrong. Your loving son, Phil.
Letters Home from Vietnam is assembled chronologically and psychologically. As the war gets bigger, the mood gets darker. The tone of the letters, like the tone of the rock music and the tone of the newscasts, gets increasingly angry. And it's all here. Platoon did it with fiction. Letters Home from Vietnam does it with reality. And does it perfectly.
David Biancooley is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with Ethley Ann Vare and Greg Potacek. Their new book, Mothers of Invention, details the work of women inventors, everything from liquid paper and drip coffee filters to radium and the first computer compiler. Also, April Fool's Day comes early. Rock historian Ed Ward shares his picks for the worst music ever recorded. And book critic John Leonard will review the newest novel by the Japanese surrealist writer Kobo Abe. Hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Ruth Harold, Gavin Morrison, and Carol Jewett. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.